Good, Morris said. But where is Alec? Was he killed? No, he's alive, Marcus said. He spread antibiotic ointment over the wound and wrapped it with gauze and tape. He said he'd meet us at the airport, but first he has to go see Luganov.
Why?
He said he had to see him about something critical that might help stop the war. Marcus stuffed the first aid kit back into his pack and tossed it behind him as he scanned the skies for the inbound hostage rescue team. At the same time, he was looking from side to side for the SUV that had gotten away, lest it was lurking in the shadows, waiting to ambush them. He knew full well he was edging close to a line. He wasn't lying to her, not quite. But he couldn't tell her a thing, not now. Perhaps not ever.
Riker, that's not acceptable,
Morris shot back.
We had orders from the President of the United States to bring the Raven out alive.
Look, he knows the risks, especially with Luganov launching an all-out mole hunt, but he was adamant. He believes he has to go see the President one more time. There was nothing I could do.
You could have grabbed him anyway.
Kidnapped him?
Call it what you want, Riker. The President gave us the green light to execute a plan you initiated. Not just to get the files, but to get the Raven.
And we will. I told you, he said he'd meet us at the airport.
That wasn't the plan.
It is now.
Please don't tell me we just killed 11 Russians to retrieve a thumb drive Mr. Kroskin could have simply left on the kitchen table for us to grab.
It was a brutal accusation, tantamount to murder. Marcus would have none of it. He pushed back with a vengeance.
We're in the fog of war, Jenny. The situation changed. Alec kept his word. He gave us what he promised. But he doesn't think it's enough. He thinks he can do more. Something that could significantly change the course of the war, or even derail it from the outset. You really think I should have kidnapped him? The son-in-law of the Russian president? What if I did? How would we get him to the airport? How would we get him out onto the plane? Drug him? And then what? Take him to a black site? Beat the crap out of him to tell us everything he knows? And what after that? If we don't kill him, we have to release him. You want him to go public with all that? Are you insane?
They continued racing through the frigid countryside in the dark of night, back to the Lukoil station to switch cars. Marcus began counting silently to 50.
Panic is contagious, but so is calm. Stay calm, do your work. Slow is smooth, smooth is smart, smart is straight, straight is deadly.
So now what?
Morris asked after several minutes.
How exactly does this play out?
It's simple, Marcus replied. The commandos arrive at the residence. They storm inside and find Alec safe in the panic room and everyone else dead. They'll ask him what happened. He'll say he doesn't know. He'll tell them the moment the shooting began, his agents grabbed him and got him to safety, which is true. He'll say he heard all the explosions and gunfire but couldn't see a thing, which is also true. He'll ask that they take him to his father-in-law immediately to tell him what happened.
And then?
Then he contacts us and makes his way to the airport, and we're out of here, Marcus said. For now, you need to get in touch with your people. Let them know there'll only be two of us at first. Tell them to have a car waiting, something that won't draw attention, parked near the plane.
Why?
So I can pick him up when he gets to the airport and get him to the plane as quickly as possible. Suddenly, they heard the sound of the choppers approaching. Marcus peered through the sunroof and through the front and side windows, but could not see them. He lowered his window slightly. Snow started swirling into the interior of the car, but above the rushing of the wind, he could hear the choppers more clearly. They were off to their left. Marcus put their distance, at least a half mile away. Moments later, they pulled into the gas station. But there at the first pump was something they had not planned for. The SUV that had gotten away, its tank being filled by a lone bodyguard. Morris slammed on the brakes, but it was too late. The agent had seen them. They were the only car on the road in the middle of the night, coming from the direction of the deadly ambush this guy had escaped from. They were dressed in black and obviously looked suspicious. At the very least, the agent was going to check them out. When he saw their weapons, they would be finished. The agent drew his sidearm and pointed it at Morris as he approached the Mercedes, shouting in Russian. Marcus knew he had to act. He bolted out of the car. Before the agent could redirect his aim and fire, Marcus pulled his rifle's trigger. The shots went wide. Now the agent was firing back, first at Marcus, then at the Mercedes. The passenger side window exploded. The rear windows were next. Morris peeled away. Marcus fired again. Bullets were crisscrossing through the frigid night air. Marcus hobbled right, still in immense pain, using the Russian's SUV to provide some cover. But at that moment, he realized he'd made a serious mistake. At first, the bodyguard started coming around the back of the truck, firing nonstop. But now Marcus saw the agent change his mind and head back to open the driver's side door. Once safely inside the bulletproof vehicle, he would call for backup, and the area would be swarming with Russian soldiers within minutes. Marcus and Morris would never get away. Knowing he had only a split second to act, Marcus forced himself to ignore the pain in his knee. He raced around the front of the truck, firing everything he had. But Marcus wasn't firing at the Russian. He was firing at the SUV's gas tank and the nozzle that was still coursing with gallons of fresh fuel. As he fired, Marcus was rapidly backing away from the service island. With the gas flowing and fumes in the air, all he needed was to create a single spark. And then he did. The massive explosion blew Marcus across the parking lot and flipped the SUV on its head. The fireball soared 20-30 feet in the air. Then came more explosions as the flames shot up the nozzle into the pump and the reserve tanks underground ignited. Morris jumped out of the SUV and raced to Marcus. She grabbed him by his flak jacket, dragged him away from the flames, and helped him to his feet. "We need to move, now," she yelled over the roar of the inferno. Together, they sprinted around behind the service building, which was completely demolished and ablaze. When they reached the Volga, Marcus found his keys, got on the driver's side, and reached over to unlock the door for Morris. Before she got in, however, he told her to go to the Mercedes, start the engine, put it into drive, aim it for the SUV, and then run for the road. He would meet her there. This time, she didn't ask questions, nor did she hesitate in the slightest. She immediately got what he was saying and ran off to get it done. Meanwhile, Marcus shoved the key in the ignition and gave it a turn. Nothing happened. He tried it again while pumping the accelerator. The engine coughed and sputtered, but refused to spring to life. Seconds later, Marcus both heard and felt the newest explosion. That was the SUV. Destroying the Mercedes would not only cover their tracks and destroy evidence, but would add to the diversion and help them escape. Morris had done her job, but he had failed in his. Their getaway car was a bust. The explosions had surely been spotted by the inbound Spetsnaz teams and no doubt by neighbors who were already calling the local fire department and the police. But Marcus stayed focused on the task at hand. Beside the Volga was a dark green Lada, a pitifully bad Russian-made compact car that looked like a miniature version of a Fiat, if such a thing were possible. This one looked like a model from the early 90s. It had little power, possibly no heat, certainly no frills. But it was theirs for the taking. Marcus wondered briefly whom the car belonged to. He had seen no one inside the service building, or anywhere else in the deserted gas station. Perhaps a night clerk had gone running when the shooting started. But he didn't have time to worry about it now. So he ditched the Volga and hobbled over to the Lada. There was no need to dust off the snow. It had all melted away in the searing heat, and the car was dripping wet. It was also locked. Marcus smashed one of the rear windows, then reached inside and unlocked the driver's side door. Reaching under the dashboard, he turned on his phone's flashlight app, pulled down a sheath of wires, and hot-wired the ignition. Within seconds, the engine was purring. They were back in business. The snow was coming down still harder. He flicked on the headlights and cranked the windshield wipers up to the maximum, then maneuvered around the blazing wreckage and found Jenny Morris standing on the side of the road. The moment she got in, Marcus floored it. He told Morris to call her boss on the secure satellite phone and alert him to the changes in their plans before pulling out her laptop and uploading all the contents of the thumb drive to Langley. Time was of the essence, and they might soon have company. 87. The Presidential Palace, Nova Agaryova, Russia, September 29th. Alek Kroskin was terrified, unsure if he could go through with it. It was almost 5:30 in the morning when the helicopter carrying him touched down on the freshly plowed landing pad beside Luganov's much larger Mi-8 chopper. So far, Marcus had been right every step of the way. From the moment the commandos had entered the panic room, he hadn't simply been questioned. He'd essentially been interrogated. The lines between the two had been badly blurred. But Alek's story had held up. No, he was not wounded, not seriously, though he'd banged up his knee in all the commotion. No, he had no idea who had attacked his parents' home. No, he hadn't seen a thing. Yes, the agents had done their jobs brilliantly and courageously. They immediately rushed him into the panic room and proceeded to fight bravely to save his life. In this, they had succeeded, and Alek had gushed his profound gratitude for every single one of them. He'd literally wept when he'd seen the carnage and the destruction throughout the house. He'd bristled, even yelled back, when he'd felt treated like a suspect. In the end, there wasn't a shred of evidence that he'd been complicit in any way. To the contrary, he appeared to have been the target of a sophisticated and brazen assassination plot. Thus, as Marcus had predicted, Alek had been cleared and brought to the palace, to his father-in-law's side, both to recover and to assist with the war effort. All that had been the easy part. What was coming next would be infinitely more difficult, testing every ounce of discipline and cunning Alek possessed. Alek grabbed his leather briefcase as six burly agents helped him out of the chopper. They created a tight cordon around him, and he limped inside the doors of the north portico. Waiting for them was another group of agents, manning a checkpoint Alek had only seen used before for the staffs of foreign heads of state, never for family, never for him. This time, however, the checkpoint supervisor surprised Alek by asking him to put his personal possessions, his watch, his wallet, briefcase, shoes, the change in his pocket, and anything else he had on him, through the X-ray machine.
"The president is expecting me," Alek said indignantly.
The FSB officer nodded again.
"Yes, sir, I understand, sir. I have urgent matters to discuss with the president."
"Of course, this will only take a moment," the officer assured him. This was not going as planned. Alek could feel beads of perspiration forming on the back of his neck.
"This is ridiculous," Alek objected again. "I've never been subjected to such things."
"My apologies, Mr. Kroskin, but these are the president's orders for everyone entering the residence," the officer replied, while his colleagues looked on. "Given all that's unfolding, we are operating under a heightened state of readiness. I'm sure you can understand. We cannot take any chances."
Feeling trapped, Alek moved directly to the officer and got in his face.
"Can't take any chances," he said. "Do you have any idea what I've just been through, what I've just survived?"
"I do, sir, and—"
"And yet, you have the gall to speak this way to me."
The tension in the air was thick. Several of the agents looked away. Still, the supervisor humbly but firmly held his ground.
"I mean no disrespect, Mr. Kroskin, but orders are orders."
The two men stood there for a moment, staring at one another. Then Alek blinked. He untied his shoes and set them on the conveyor belt. He removed his belt and his cufflinks and his watch and wallet and a fountain pen from his breast pocket and put them on the conveyor belt as well. The operator immediately moved the items through the machine.
"The briefcase, too, if you wouldn't mind," the supervisor said,
noticing that Alec had initially set the bag on the floor when he removed his shoes, but hadn't placed it on the conveyor belt. Alec's heart was pounding. If he was stopped here, it would be disastrous. Not only would Marcus's plan be ruined and the war proceed, but Alec would be going straight to the bowels of Lubyanka to face the torturers of the FSB, and a fate far worse than death. He picked up the briefcase.
"Do you have a laptop?" the supervisor asked.
"I do," Alec said.
"Please take it out and run it through separately."
Alec did as he was asked. Time seemed to stand still as the X-ray operator studied every square inch of every item. When each one was cleared and emerged on the other side, a different agent examined it manually. He removed the battery of the notebook computer, studied it closely, and then replaced it and turned the computer on. When it flickered to life, the officer was satisfied. He turned it off again, then turned his attention to the briefcase, thoroughly checking every section. When he found an unopened pack of cigarettes, he carefully tore the cellophane away, opened the pack, and dumped the contents on the counter. Convinced nothing was amiss, he put each cigarette back in its place and the pack back in the pocket of the briefcase where he'd found it. Next, he pulled out a small digital voice recorder. The officer opened up the back and removed the batteries. Then he opened a drawer in a desk behind him, fished out batteries of the same kind, and put these in the device. He turned the recorder on, but no sound emerged. The device was new. No messages had yet been recorded on it. Satisfied, the officer replaced the device in the briefcase and nodded.
"You're all set."
Alec began breathing again and was about to work his way around the magnetometer like he always did. However, the supervisor asked Alec to take off his raincoat and his suit coat and put them through the X-ray machine as well.
"Then I'll need you to step through the metal detector," he said.
Alec just stared at him.
"Again, my sincerest apologies, Mr. Kraskin, but the President's orders."
Alec paused, trying hard to look annoyed and not terrified. But terrified he was, and he could stall no longer. There was no way he was going to make it through the metal detector without setting it off. He would be immediately searched and quickly arrested when they found the gun. Slowly, with a room full of agents watching him, he took off his coat and put it on the conveyor belt. Then he did the same with the jacket of his suit. When the operator turned on the belt and both items began moving through the X-ray machine, Alec straightened his tie, wondering what to do next. There was no place to run, no place to hide. This was it, the end of the road. Why hadn't he fled the country with Marcus Riker? 88. Resolved to his fate, Alec took a deep breath and limped forward. The machine started beeping. He put out his hands, preparing to be wanded. Just then, Dmitry Nimkov came around the corner.
"That'll be all?"
Nimkov barked before any of the officers could begin the search.
"How dare you treat the President's own son-in-law like this, especially after all he's just been through? What's wrong with you men? Have you no respect for the family?"
The men froze. Alec was ashen. None of them moved, but Nimkov put his arm around Alec and helped him gather his belongings. When Alec was finished putting on his shoes and belt, he collected the rest of his things and put them in his briefcase along with his computer. Then he put his suit jacket back on, draped his raincoat over his arm, and as calmly as he could, thanked the FSB chief, surely the last man he'd expected to help him clear security.
"My pleasure, Alek Stepanovich,"
Nimkov said.
"Come, the President is waiting for you."
"Then by all means, lead on,"
Alek replied, though he knew the route by heart. When Nimkov saw Alek moving so slowly, his left leg stiff as a board and pain streaked across his face,
He asked what had happened. Alex said it was nothing. He'd fallen during the rush to get to the panic room, inflaming an old hockey injury. As they snaked through several hallways, Alec noticed they were passing far more agents than were typically posted inside the residence. They were stationed every 10 meters or so. Through the windows, Alec couldn't help but notice canine units roaming the grounds. Sharpshooters in Arctic combat wear were visible on the roofs of the outbuildings. With each step, Alec felt his fears rising and his resolve weakening. Finally, they turned a corner and arrived outside Luganov's private study. Stationed in that hallway were no fewer than 6 elite members of the Presidential Bodyguard Division. None of Luganov's team was more trusted than these, and trusted most of all was Special Agent Kovalyov, posted directly in front of the door. Kovalyov nodded as Alek and Nimkov approached. He knew them both well. Nevertheless, he asked both to present photo IDs. This was unheard of, yet neither man argued. Both dug their IDs out of their wallets. Kovalyov studied them closely, then studied the men's faces. Alek felt sure the man was going to see right through him. But he returned the IDs and stepped aside from the door to let them through. The heavy, thick, steel-reinforced door opened into a short, carpeted, empty hallway. An additional security measure to make absolutely certain that no unauthorized person could approach the president. Nimkov, knowing his place, let Alec enter first. When Alec limped to the door at the other end of the hallway, he knocked twice. Only when he heard his father-in-law bid him enter did he open the door. The president was sitting beside his desk in an overstuffed chair, gazing vacantly at walls lined with books of every kind, from esteemed Russian literature to military histories and biographies of great leaders, to Western novels, especially political thrillers, for which Luganov had a weakness. He was dressed casually in blue jeans, a navy blue V-neck sweater over a white T-shirt and boots. And he was smoking a cigar. There was a roaring fire in the stone fireplace. There was also an open bottle of Stolichnaya and a half-empty glass. That didn't bode well so early in the morning, Alec thought.
Alec Stepanovich, it's you. Finally, you live and breathe, said Luganov, his speech slightly slurred, though that could have been as much from lack of sleep as an abundance of alcohol.
Alec nodded, but then turned on the FSB chief without warning.
I'm alive, but no thanks to the imbeciles this man assigned to me, father. Dmitri Dmitrovich, how is it that you have such incompetence on my security detail? How is it that you have allowed my life to be put in such danger?
Nimkov was completely caught off guard, and Alec stayed on the attack. It was his father-in-law, after all, who had taught him the best defense was a good offense.
Dmitri Dmitrovich, tell us, have you hunted down the filthy pigs who tried to kill me? Have you captured any of them? Have you killed any of them? Or is this too much for you, and these sniveling, pathetic morons working for you?
Nimkov tried to respond, but Luganov intervened.
Come, come, sit down, Alek Stefanovich, the president said. Set aside your coat and your briefcase and have a seat. You have been through a terrible ordeal. I know you are angry, and I am as well. But there is no need to take out your frustrations on the FSB or its esteemed director. We are on the same team, are we not?
Luganov motioned to an unoccupied chair to his left. Alec reluctantly took it. Nimkov sat in the chair to the president's right. Then Luganov pushed a buzzer on his desk, and seconds later a steward entered.
Bring some tea for my son, and breakfast for us all, Luganov ordered. It has been a long night. I think we all need some sustenance.
Luganov looked around the room. Neither Alek nor Nimkov said a word.
Yes, Your Excellency, right away, sir.
When the steward stepped out of the room and closed the door behind him,
Luganov gave the FSB director the floor.
I deeply apologize, Alex Stefanovich,
Nimkov began.
This was a terrible breach in our security. I'm afraid we do not have any of the perpetrators in custody. But my men are thoroughly scouring the crime scene. And I guarantee we will make arrests sooner than you might think.
The way Nimkov uttered this last sentence worried Alek. Was this a threat? Delivered right here in the presence of the president himself? Alek wondered what mistakes Marcus and his team had committed, what incriminating evidence they had left behind, and how quickly, if at all, it could be linked to him. Even more, however, Alek wondered how long Nimkov was going to stay. The plan Marcus had given him hadn't factored in a second man in the room, least of all the head of Russia's security services.
Dmitri Dmitrievich, what do you know so far? Luganov asked.
For starters, Your Excellency, we have recovered one of the getaway cars the attackers used,
Nimkov explained.
Well, recovered probably isn't the correct term. Located is more like it. A Mercedes, an SUV. My men found it 6 miles away from the Kraskin estate.
Where exactly?
At a Lukoil gas station the terrorists blew up to cover their tracks.
Blew up?
The president asked.
Completely demolished, and the fire still raging, Nimkov confirmed. It will take some time to sort out the damage. One of my agents was found dead at the scene, shell casings everywhere. Seems there was quite a shootout. It all went down just as our hostage rescue team was arriving to get you, Alek Stefanovich. As best we can tell at the moment, our man was in hot pursuit of the Mercedes. The two vehicles may have crashed into the gas station. It's not yet clear, but the roads were slippery in the snow.
Alek was aghast at the news, suddenly wondering if Marcus was even still alive.
What else have you found?
He asked, convinced it was in his best interest to stay on the offensive.
How many attacked the house, and who were they? Chechens?
I'm glad you asked, Alek Stefanovich, because that's one of the strangest things about the attack, said Dimkov. We haven't found the bodies of any of the terrorists in or around your family home.
None?
Strange, isn't it? 12 of my men are dead, not a single perpetrator. Yet ballistics confirms all of them were firing their weapons.
More evidence of their incompetence, if you ask me,
Alek fumed. He was trying to put on a good show, but he worried where this was going. He had no idea how many men Marcus had brought with him. He hadn't asked ahead of time, because he didn't want to know. He hadn't asked afterward, because there hadn't been time. But given the magnitude of the gun battle and the destruction caused to the house, surely there had been at least 6 or 8. That's what Alek had assumed, anyway. And it was inconceivable the FSB agents hadn't taken out at least a few of them.
Perhaps it was incompetence, said Nimkov, rising to his feet. Or perhaps there's another explanation.
Like what?
Alek asked. He noticed that his father-in-law was being unusually quiet during the conversation.
Perhaps they were set up.
Set up? How?
Perhaps someone tipped them off. Someone on the inside. Someone trying to cover up a crime.
Only your men knew where I was going to be tonight, Alek shot back. My own parents didn't know, nor did Marina. Is there a mole inside the FSB?
There's a mole somewhere. That much seems clear, Nimkov said.
The FSB chief turned to the president.
May I?
Luganov assented. So Nimkov walked over to a television console that Alek noticed was hooked up to a laptop computer.
I have some surveillance video footage I brought for the president to see. Now that you're here, I'd like to show you as well, Alek Stefanovich. And then, with the president's permission, I may have a few questions.
89.
Heard anything?
Morris asked.
Not yet. 5 minutes from Domodedovo International Airport, Marcus pulled off the highway and turned onto Ilyushina Street. He parked the Lada in the rear lot of the Ramada. Morris checked the laptop. The files were done uploading. She pulled out the thumb drive and handed it back to Marcus. Then they quickly stuffed their weapons, ammo, radios, flak jackets, balaclavas, and other supplies into large duffel bags, shoved those in the trunk, locked the doors, and slipped into the building through a side door using a key card Morris had brought with her, per the extraction plan they'd jointly designed days earlier. Once inside, the two headed directly for the restrooms off the lobby. There, each found a bag pre-positioned for them at the bottom of the trash bins. Each bag contained a change of clothes, a winter hat, coat, gloves, boots, a wig, glasses, a fake passport, and an airport ID, and in Marcus's case, a fake mustache and goatee. Marcus washed the blood and sweat from his face and hands, then rewrapped his knee with fresh gauze and tape. He changed into the dark blue coveralls and work boots, put on the rest of the disguise, and went back outside, where a Ramada shuttle bus, driven by one of Morris's men, pulled up. The shuttle drove them directly to the private aviation terminal on the far side of the field, opposite the commercial passenger terminals. Once there, the two disembarked and proceeded through security, as if they were members of the ground crew arriving for their morning shift. A bleary-eyed security guard paid scant attention to either of them as they passed through the metal detectors. They weren't carrying any weapons or explosives. They had no bags or other personal items to inspect, so they were waved through in fairly short order. Heading to the flight line, they spotted the Gulfstream 4 with the tail number they'd been given in advance and climbed aboard, nodding to the actual ground crew members finishing their pre-flight preparations. Neither Marcus nor Morris drew any attention. As the early winter storm intensified, the crew was freezing and exhausted and eager to finish their shift and get home to their families. On board, Morris stepped to the cockpit, knocked four times, and whispered a code word. A moment later, the cockpit door opened, and two CIA officers, dressed as pilots, emerged and greeted them. Morris and the woman pilot headed to the two washrooms. Marcus and the man headed to the back of the plane, where they swapped clothes in the galley. Then the officer gave him a key to an airport security car parked near the door to the terminal. "Is it covered in snow?" Marcus asked. "Shouldn't be too bad," the officer replied. "We've brushed it down every 15 minutes and turned over the engine twice. You should be good to go."
"And the weapons?"
The officer handed over a Russian-made pistol. It was a newer and larger model than the one Marcus had given to Alec, and it was, as he'd insisted, equipped with a silencer. The officer said there was also a submachine gun in a canvas bag on the floor of the vehicle he'd set aside for them, and two other automatic rifles and plenty of ammunition under the seats in the cockpit, just in case. The swap was soon complete. The CIA officers were now dressed as members of the ground crew. Morris was dressed as the lead pilot, as she was the only one of the two actually licensed and rated to fly a Gulfstream, particularly in weather like this. Marcus was dressed as her co-pilot. He'd earned his private pilot license when he was younger, but on single-engine prop planes, not jets, and certainly not a G-4. Morris thanked her colleagues, as did Marcus, and they deplaned. Marcus raised the steps and locked the cabin door, while Morris went to the cockpit to review their pre-flight checklist. There was still no word from Alec, and Marcus was getting worried. He'd expected something by now. Unspoken between him and Morris, but very much up in the air, was the question for which Marcus didn't have an answer. How long would they wait before they had to cut Alec loose and leave without him? Alec stared at the TV screen, his face pale and his hands trembling slightly. He was no longer on offense. Before Dmitri Nimkov could resume his questioning, the chief steward knocked twice. Luganov said he could enter, and soon they were being served cheese omelets, sweet rolls, fresh fruit, and steaming chai. The steward poured each man a cup. Lubanov quickly grew impatient and waved him away, and he slipped out.
"Who was the girl?" Nimkov asked, standing over him.
At first, Alek was too shocked to respond.
"We're going to find out soon enough," Nimkov continued. "Don't presume to waste the president's patience or his goodwill."
Still, Alek could not find the words. So shocked was he by the tape he'd just seen.
"Did you find her on your own?"
the FSB chief went on.
"Or did Markus Riker provide her for you?"
"You have no idea what you're talking about, Dmitri Dmitrovich,"
Alek finally responded.
"Surely you cannot deny you gave the slip to your security detail last Wednesday night,"
Nimkov noted.
"Surely you cannot deny you checked into the Hotel National, or that you paid cash for your room, and asked for a room that just happened to be next to a member of Senator Dayton's delegation, can you?"
Alek couldn't bear to look at his father-in-law, but the contempt he had for Nimkov was reaching the boiling point.
"I believe you are actually acquainted with Special Agent Riker, are you not?"
Nimkov pressed, clearly relishing his role as interrogator.
"You met him before in Berlin."
Alek said nothing. The plan was falling apart before his eyes.
"Surely you do not deny this, do you, Alek Stefanovich?"
Alek began to panic.
"How can you?"
the FSB chief continued, his confidence increasing, his voice growing angrier.
"You sit there next to your leader, so smug, with such hubris and contempt, refusing to answer my questions. But I already know the answers. I have sworn affidavits from no fewer than 5 witnesses that you interrupted a meeting in the German Chancellery to introduce yourself to Mr. Riker when he was working for the U.S. Secret Service. What conclusion should the President draw from this?"
Alek could feel the pistol warm against his flesh, but he could not reach for it. Not yet.
"My staff retrieved your written report from that trip. You made no mention of unauthorized personal contact with a member of the American government. Yet this just so happens to be the very same person whom you allowed into a meeting with President Luganov in the hours leading up to a war. And it just so happens to be the person in the room next to yours at the Hotel National. Is the president to conclude this is merely happenstance?"
Alek felt physically ill.
"And the woman? Tell us who she is,"
Nimkov demanded.
"It's all on video, Alek Stefanovich. Enough of your silence and stonewalling. Are you really going to sit there and tell us you're not cheating on the daughter of His Excellency?"
Alek was ready to respond, but Luganov, livid, cut him off.
"Alek Stefanovich, give me the little tart's name and be done with it,"
the president demanded, rising to his feet, his face beet red. Just then, Nimkov's mobile phone rang. The FSB chief glanced at the president. The timing was terrible, but they were less than 48 hours from launching a war. Luganov nodded, and Nimkov answered it.
"Not now,"
he replied to the voice at the other end.
"Of course I understand, but he's busy with a matter of national security. No, I will call you when I can."
"Who is it?"
Luganov snapped.
"It's Agent Kovalyov, sir,"
Nimkov replied.
"Miss Slutsky needs to see you. She says it's urgent. What would you have him do?"
"She will wait,"
Luganov said, as angry as Alek had ever seen him.
"And tell Pavel I will not be interrupted again. I will let him know when I am finished. Until then, I am not to be disturbed. Do I make myself clear?"
"Perfectly, Your Excellency,"
Nimkov replied, and he passed the message on. Both men were now towering over Alek, and Alek could bear it no longer. He would answer their questions. He would tell them what they wanted to know. He had to. What other choice did he have? 90.
Yes, Dmitri Dmitrovich, I deny it. I deny it all.
Alek, still sitting, leveled his icy gaze at the FSB chief.
I'm not having an affair, nor would I ever. How dare you imply that I would?
He shifted to the president, and lowered his voice to be, or at least to appear to be, respectful of a father and a leader.
Her name?
He said.
Her name is Marina Alexandrovna Luganova. I have loved her from the day we met in college, and I have never been unfaithful. Not once. Not ever.
Now it was Luganov and Nimkov who were taken aback, both by Alek's defense, and the ferocity and deep sense of conviction with which he made it.
I've been working too long, he said,
his voice more subdued, regret thick in his voice.
I was never home. I missed Vasily, and I missed Marina even more. So I called her that evening from my office, checked the phone logs. I asked her to come down to the hotel and stay the night with me. I asked her to be discreet, to enter through a side door, to wear a scarf so no one could recognize her. The last thing I wanted to do was attract any attention to her or to you, father.
Luganov was so stunned that he physically backed up several steps. Nimkov was clearly caught off guard as well. He followed the president's lead and stepped back from Alek, though not quite as far.
Is this true? Luganov asked. It is, Alek said. All of it. Call Marina. Ask her yourself. She will tell you. I'm not a traitor. And I'm certainly not an adulterer. I love this country. And I love your daughter more than life itself. And I would do anything to protect them.
The room was silent. The food and tea sat there, cold and untouched. Nimkov picked up the phone on the desk, but Luganov grabbed the receiver from him.
I will do it myself. Sit down, Dmitri Dmitrovich. We will clear this up right now.
Nimkov sat as Luganov asked the palace operator to connect him to his ex-wife's home and get his daughter on the line. Alek winced and held his stomach.
Father, may I go to the restroom?
Irritated, perhaps at the question, perhaps that Marina wasn't already on the line, Luganov grunted his approval. Alek stood and limped for the door. There was a bathroom down the hall, but Nimkov put out his hand and blocked his path.
Use this one, he said,
pointing to the washroom connected to the study.
It's reserved for the president,
Alek replied.
Under the circumstances, I'm sure he won't mind. We wouldn't want you to wander off.
Alek looked to his father-in-law, who again grunted his assent after cursing the operators and demanding things move faster.
Don't take too long, Nimkov instructed. We're not finished.
Alek said nothing, but hobbled into the lavatory and closed and locked the door behind him. He glanced around. There were no windows, nor would there be any hidden cameras. He turned on the faucet, so the men outside could hear water running. Then he unbuckled his trousers. He had duct-taped the small pistol Marcus had given him to his inner left thigh, just below the groin. This was why he'd been limping. He'd never injured his knee. Alek waited several moments, then reached over and flushed the toilet to mask the sound of tape tearing from his skin. Setting the gun on the vanity, he pulled his trousers back up and buckled them again. As he pulled all the tape away and tossed it into the toilet, he stared at the pistol.
So this was it, Alek thought.
He'd done everything Marcus Riker had told him. He'd actually made it onto the grounds of the presidential palace, past dozens of armed bodyguards, even past the head of the FSB, with a loaded gun. The question was whether he could go any further. Alek had never killed anyone. Yes, he'd done his time in the army. But after basic training, he'd served as a clerk in the office of the chief counsel. Was he really going to walk through these doors and shoot
Not just one, but two men in cold blood? Neither he nor Marcus had wargamed a scenario in which a second person would be in the room. Certainly not Dmitri Nemkov. Had they considered the possibility that the FSB would have actually made the connection between Alec and Riker in the Hotel National? Such a development complicated matters enormously. Now there was a very real risk that Marcus, and thus the American government, could be linked to what Alec was about to do. He hadn't actually been sick to his stomach when he'd asked to be excused. Now he was. Was he really going to do this? Was he going to kill the father of his own wife, the grandfather of his only son? And even if he tried, would he be able to shoot the president before Nemkov could draw and fire back at him? Was it better to take out Nemkov first? Doubts surged through him, but there was precious little time for indecision. Marcus had been clear. Once he was alone in a room with Luganov, he should ask permission to use the restroom, retrieve the gun, and then come back into the room with the pistol drawn and fire immediately. Marcus had insisted he use the element of surprise to maximum advantage. Alec wanted to live. He wanted to see Marina and Vasily again. He wanted to hold them and grow old with them. But these were no longer options. Not if he went out of this room, gun blazing. For a moment, he considered taking his own life right there in the lavatory. But that wouldn't stop the war. And it was the coward's way out. Alec thought again of Solzhenitsyn. How could he keep silent in the face of evil? How could he live with himself by burying the truth so deep, or ignoring it so completely, that it could rise up a thousandfold in the future? To do nothing might save his life, but did it not condemn millions of others? Only one thing would stop this terrible war from being set into motion and wreaking such mournful havoc on the whole of the Russian nation, to say nothing of the rest of the world. Alec was the one man in a position to change the course of history. He knew that. Yet, looking at himself in the mirror, at his exhausted, bloodshot eyes and the dark circles under them, he wondered. Could he pull the trigger? He wanted to. But was he fooling himself? Surely Marcus Riker could do it. But could Alec Kraskin?
91. Nemkov started pounding on the bathroom door.
Alec Stepanovich, that's enough. I have more questions, as does your father.
It was time to face his accusers and his fate. Alec flushed the toilet one more time. He washed his hands and his face and dried them with a plush towel. Then he took off his tie, rebuttoned his suit coat, and opened the door. Nemkov was standing there, waiting for him.
"Before you say anything, Dmitri Dmitrovich, I am ready to talk,"
Alec said, holding up his hand.
"In fact, there is much I want to tell you. Perhaps you will call it a confession, but I don't see it that way."
Nemkov said nothing, but did step aside to let Alec re-enter the study. Alec did so, careful to continue limping, then turned to look directly at his father-in-law.
"I am ready to talk, father, and I am ready to face the consequences. I have not done what I have been accused of. I am not a traitor, but there are things I must say, and I will say them to you."
"Very well, Alec Stefanovich," the president replied. "But first, let me say that I have spoken with Marina, and she confirms your story in every detail, except one."
"What is that, father?"
"She says at one point in the night in question, you asked her to step into the bathroom with her iPod and her headphones, and to wait there, listening to music, until you told her it was safe to come out. She did not question you, but I must."
"I understand," Alec said softly.
"Good."
Luganov took his seat,
and ordered Alek and Nimkov to take theirs as well. Nimkov did. Alek did not.
If it's all right with you, father, I would like to remain standing, Alek replied, holding his sides. I am very nervous, terrified, actually. And my stomach is weak, and honestly, I'm not sure I could remain still if I were sitting.
Say it, stand. It makes no difference to me, but start talking, Luganov said. Start with last Wednesday night at the Hotel Nacional. What did you do from the moment you sent Marina into the restroom?
Alek could see both men were still angry. They'd taken a few steps back from the brink, but he had to calm them down, put them at ease. That might not be possible, but he had to try.
If I may, I would like to begin with what I did not do, Alek said. I did not betray Mother Russia. I did not betray the Russian people. But there was business I had to attend to that night that could not wait. Business of the highest order that related to the security, indeed the very future, of our country.
You made contact with Marcus Riker, Nimkov interjected. You knocked on his door. You woke him up. You made contact with the American. And you told him what the president, your own father-in-law, was planning. Admit it, Alek Stefanovich. No more lies. We have neither the time nor the patience for...
At this, Alek erupted.
Silence, Dmitri Dmitrievich! Silence! I told you I would tell you my story, and I shall. But you don't even have the decency to hear me out. You've already been proven wrong once today. I was not having an affair. I was not being lured into a honey trap. I was not doing anything at that hotel for which I should feel guilty or ashamed. Now I'm ready to tell you more, but all you have are accusations, and slanderous ones at that.
Nimkov was turning red, and about to rise out of his seat, but Alek exploded again.
No, you will sit down, you will be quiet, and you will let me speak uninterrupted, Dmitri Dmitrievich.
There was a knock at the door. It was Agent Kovalyov.
Is everything all right, Your Excellency?
The bodyguard asked through the door.
May I come in?
No! I said no interruptions!
Luganov shouted back.
Disregard me again and I'll have your head!
Kovalyov apologized profusely. The door to the study remained closed, and after a moment, they heard the second door, the one to the hallway, close as well. With Kovalyov back at his post, Luganov ordered Alek to continue. During the interruption, Alek had turned away from the two men and was staring out the bulletproof window at the snow falling in the courtyard, all lit up by a series of outdoor lamps ringing the colonnade. He nodded to confirm that he would continue, but he needed a moment to catch his breath and quiet the blood pounding in his head. His eye landed on a birdbath in the center of the courtyard that had at least 2 or 3 inches of snow piled up on it already. During the rest of the year, there was typically patio furniture set up around the pool. Now the pool was drained and covered. Alek remembered happier times out there. How many summer days had he and Marina swum laps or played with Vasily in the shallow end? How many truly lovely meals had they shared with the first couple, before all the tensions with Yulia had reached the tipping point, before Yulia had been sent away, and Katya Slatsky had entered the picture permanently? Alek's life in this family had never been idyllic. He knew that all too well. There had been some moments he could cherish and wanted to hold on to, but they were far too few. And it was clear there could never be any more. Not where the president was taking Russia. The house was not yet burning, but the match was lit.
Here I am, in your home, father,
Alek said softly.
The home of your daughter, my wife. A home I once thought was mine as well.
He turned back around, but could not bear to look at Nimkov. He looked only at Luganov, fighting to keep his voice calm and measured.
I remember when the people elected you president. I remember standing at your side when you took the oath of office, and swore to protect the people and lead us wisely. I remember every word.
I swear, in exercising the powers of the President of the Russian Federation, to respect and protect the rights and freedoms of man and citizen, to respect and defend the Constitution of the Russian Federation, to protect the sovereignty and independence, security, and integrity of the state, to faithfully serve the people.
What happened to all that, Father? What happened to all that you promised us?
The question hung in the air for a moment. Then Alec unbuttoned his jacket, drew the pistol, and fired directly in Luganov's face. A puff of red mist filled the air. Then Alec pivoted to Ninkov, whose eyes were wide with shock, and pulled the trigger a second time. Blood was everywhere. Alec was covered in it. He stared at the two bodies slumped in their overstuffed chairs. When he saw one of Luganov's legs twitch, he refused to be calmed by the possibility that this was merely a death spasm. Instead, Alec stepped closer to the man who had believed himself a czar, placed the barrel of the pistol directly to his forehead, and fired again. 92. True to Riker's word, the gun had made almost no noise. Both Luganov and Nimkov had been so stunned by Alec's attack and had died so quickly that neither of them had made a sound either. Thus, neither Kovalyov nor any of the agents stationed outside came bursting into the room. They'd been ordered not to enter the study until the president informed them he was ready. That, at least, bought Alec some time. Trembling slightly, yet far more calm than he would have imagined, Alec walked over to Luganov's desk and picked up the blood-spattered phone. It was time to set the rest of Marcus's plan in motion.
"This is Alec Stefanovich Kraskin," he said softly when the palace operator greeted him. "I'm here with the president, and he has several requests he'd like me to pass along. First, His Excellency and Mr. Nimkov need to head back to the Kremlin and would like to depart at precisely 8 a.m. Please advise the flight crew and his security detail to be ready at that time."
Alec waited for her to get that down.
"Second, the president has ordered me to go to Brussels, so I need you to contact the head of flight operations and have a plane fueled up and waiting for me at Domodedovo Airport. Please inform the pilot of my helicopter that I need to get to the airport right away. I'll be at the helipad in 3 minutes. Once at Domodedovo, I'll need a secure lounge to place calls and make preparations for my trip. Got all that?"
Again, he waited.
"There is one more thing," he concluded. "The president needs Miss Slutsky to meet him at the Kremlin, but please let her know that she will not be able to travel with him. Kindly inform her that she can fly with me. Once they drop me off at the airport, the pilot can take her the rest of the way. Is that clear?" "Good. If you need anything, text me. In the meantime, please continue holding all calls into the president's study, and make sure all staff, all of them, know not to disturb His Excellency or Mr. Nimkov until it's time to leave for the Kremlin." "Right, you know the drill, war preparations, etc." "Yes, and you as well. Good day."
Hanging up the phone, Alec walked back across the room and closed the drapes. Then he switched on several lamps around the study and went through his mental checklist. Ah, yes, the mobile phones. He turned to Luganov, searched around, and finally found his phone in his back pocket. He used it rarely, mostly when he wanted to have unrecorded conversations with Katya. Next, he patted Nimkov down until he found his mobile phone in the right pocket of his suit jacket. He was tempted to steal them. Both phones, particularly the FSB chief's, had invaluable intelligence on them. But Marcus had been explicit. Silence them so they could not ring, but do not take them. Mobile phones could be tracked. Lifting one would trigger suspicion and a response. Alec checked his watch. He needed to get moving. He stepped back inside the restroom and calmly washed the blood off his hands and face. He wiped off his suit and his shoes, then dried his hands.